Modern.
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 We're prepping for a voyage.
Modern.
The force of an old-fashioned equals whiskey mass times bitters acceleration.
Why don't you make that a double?
Modern bar cart.
What's shaking, cocktail fans? Welcome to episode 281 of the Modern Bar Cart podcast. I'm your host, Eric Koslick. Thanks for joining me for this interview episode where I track down the best and brightest minds in the spirits and cocktail world so that I can share their secrets with you. This time around, I'm joined by Paul Clark. He's the editor-in-chief at Imbibe Magazine, author of The Cocktail Chronicles, and host of the Radio Imbibe podcast, which is one of my favorite shows to listen to when I'm not working on this one. Paul and I pulled up a seat during our recent spirits judging stint at the American Distilling Institute's annual International Spirits Competition to explore the legacy of one of the cocktail renaissance's most beloved bartenders, Murray Stenson. Upon his passing in September of 2023, Murray was memorialized for the major part he played in bringing the last word cocktail back onto the world stage after decades of obscurity, but he also played a massively important role in stewarding the overall cocktail culture of Seattle for many years. So this conversation, like its cocktail namesake, is an equal parts mix of history, elegy, technique, and idiosyncrasy. But before we dive in, let's take a brief pause so that you can make yourself a drink. This episode's featured cocktail is the Industry Sour. To make this last word variant, you'll need either 3/4 of an ounce or 1 ounce each of the following. Fernet Branca, which is a minty Alpine Amaro from Italy, green chartreuse, simple syrup, and fresh squeezed lime juice. Combine these ingredients in a cocktail shaker with ice, give them a good hard shake until the drink is properly chilled and diluted, then strain into a stemmed cocktail glass and enjoy. Developed by St. Louis bartender Ted Kilgore in 2011, I think of the Industry Sour as an offspring of the last word designed, as its name implies, specifically for nerdy cocktail bartenders who are in the know about esoteric ingredients like chartreuse and Fernet. In this case, the Fernet kind of stands in for the gin, which works, since it's a dry botanical liqueur. And instead of that double shot of sweetness and nuttiness from the usual maraschino liqueur, the Industry Sour takes kind of a half step back with the use of plain old simple syrup, something that any good cocktail bartender will have within arm's reach. For me, the only real shame is that the pearlescent green color of the last word is replaced by a kind of muddy brown in this riff. But again, it seems fitting. Anyone can walk up to something as beautiful as the last word and understand they've got something special. But it takes a true cocktail acolyte to really appreciate the complex, aggressive symphony contained in the brownish soup of the Industry Sour. So, now that you've got a brand new last word variation to trot out the next time you host a meeting of the Cocktail Cognoscenti, let's turn our attention back to the interview. In this Seattle cocktail retrospective with Paul Clark, editor-in-chief of Imbibe Magazine, some of the topics we discuss include how Paul began his drinks journey back in the early days of the cocktail renaissance and became a regular at the Zigzag Cafe, a Seattle cocktail den that rose to prominence thanks in large part to a bartender named Murray Stenson. The fascinating gravitational pull that Murray exerted both within professional hospitality circles and on the community of cocktail enthusiasts who congregated at his bar. How Murray resurrected the last word cocktail from the pages of a forgotten 1950s cocktail book, and why his quest for the weird, wonderful, and esoteric extended far beyond cocktails. We also examine hospitality through the lens of an old-school bartender, someone who understands that the people are more important than the drinks, and we try to collect some takeaways for young bartenders who are just starting out on their hospitality journey. Along the way, we consider the merits of large vinyl collections and a lifelong fascination with music, the simple pleasure of spilling your unique weirdness to the bartender after a couple drinks, why Murray was too cool for award ceremonies, and much, much more. As I prepared for this interview, and now as I'm preparing it for you, I've spent a lot of time thinking about the purpose of elegy. why we derive meaning from commemorating someone who's passed away. In the case of a service industry veteran who cared for tens of thousands of thirsty patrons and likely poured hundreds of thousands of drinks over the course of a decades-long career, I think for me, it boils down, at least partially, to a sense of awe at the sheer amount of hospitality that was channeled through someone like Murray. It makes you wonder, how can one person remember so many regulars and their drink orders? How can you show up day after day and manage to not get swept up in the ephemeral glitz and glam of cocktail culture? How can you take a profession with so much repetition and tedious labor and somehow imbue it with a sense of soul? I guess maybe that's the purpose of Elegy, a reminder that these questions are still important and that they're now for us to try and figure out. With that, please enjoy this fascinating trip back into the early days of the cocktail renaissance with Paul Clark. Paul, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Eric. It's great to be here.
For our listeners who aren't familiar with you personally, although I suspect many will be familiar with your work, could you just give us a quick bio intro just to kick us off here?
Sure, absolutely. So I am a journalist. That's the short answer. I've been working on cocktails, spirits, and the culture of drink, for almost 20 years now. For the past 10 years, I've been the editor-in-chief at Imbibe magazine. I've been writing for Imbibe since issue number one in 2006. Over the course of the years, I've also written for a number of other publications, newspapers, websites. Sites along the way, wrote a book somewhere in there, contributed to other stuff, have the Radio Imbibe podcast. I've done a number of other drinks related things for almost two decades now.
Yeah. Well, you and I met here, actually in Tiburon, California, mm-hmm. at the ADI International Spirits Competition a few years back. And it's been fun. Obviously, I've been consuming Imbibe for a while, and it's been fun listening to your podcast as well. So I'm excited to speak with you today about something that you, as a cocktail journalist and a Seattle person, I don't mm-hmm. know if you're a Seattle native, but you're certainly a Seattle denizen, that you're uniquely qualified to talk about, which is part cocktail, but also part bartender. So I guess my first question is, when did you meet a gentleman by the name of Murray Stenson?
Well, I knew Murray by reputation long before I met him in person. You know, my own, I need to back up a little bit. My own first personal interest in cocktails and cocktail history and craft cocktails and everything that was becoming the cocktail renaissance started around 2003. And at the time, you know, there were very few bars scattered around the country, around the world that were really kind of like devoting themselves to craft cocktails. Zigzag Cafe in Seattle was one of those. And it was one of those largely because of Murray Stenson. So just, you know, initially when I was just Googling around or going on to some of the sites like Drink Boy or eGullet, that was another website where a lot of us, you know, kind of congregated. I was hearing about Murray, like, this is a bar you need to check out. So I went down there a couple of times early on, but I was nobody, man. You know, I was just kind of curious about cocktails. So I went in, ordered a cocktail. This is delicious. This is tasty. Paid my bill and left. In 2005, after I'd been studying this for a couple of years and collecting old bartending manuals and things of that nature, I started a blog, which is what you did in those days. You know, that was the fashion of the time to start a blog if you had a certain kind of, you know, fascination with the subject. So I started mine, the Cocktail Chronicles, in the spring of 2005. And, you know, as with all kinds of blogs like that, you assume your readership is about maybe half a dozen people and a couple bots. And somewhere along the lines, I got a message through my website regarding some kind of cocktail exploration that I've been posting about and said, hey, you know, this sounds really interesting. If you want to check it out in person, come down to my bar. I'd love to host you. And then it was signed Murray Stenson. I was like, of course I know who you are, man. But that was the first time we went down, met him face to face, did an introduction, had a conversation, and had a few cocktails from him.
Yeah. I don't know that I would have expected your first, I guess, interaction with an old school bartender, mm-hmm. which is kind of the way that I think of Murray, even though I've never met him, mm-hmm. to be
on a blog. That seems that seems like really progressive, but maybe that's part of the story here.
Well, I think you know everybody's on the internet, or most people are on the internet, and that included Murray. I think he found interesting sites, interesting food sites, interesting drink sites, because you know he was plumbing the depths of cocktail history long before it became a thing to do that, and he was doing that for menus, but also just for his his own personal edification. And I think finding somebody else who's doing that, especially somebody local, there weren't too many of us in those days, so you kind of found each other and gravitated together.
Yeah, gravity sounds like a pretty good way to describe it, right? It's like there's an attractive force that doesn't seem like we're entirely in control of.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, in Seattle, I mentioned Zigzag was one of the only places at the time that was kind of practicing this. I should also mention we were also home to Robert Hess, better known as Drink Boy, and host of the Drink Boy forums at that time. And Robert, of course, had long engaged with Zigzag and had been posting on his website and on these various forums about the drinks they'd been making down there. So that was a big part of my education. I didn't know Robert personally at that time yet, but it was kind of there were a limited handful of people, not even a handful of people in Seattle kind of doing this. And, of course, we're going to find each other.
Yeah. Well, I guess my next question is a little bit about Murray's style, his personal flair, because obviously he exerted early on within this small sphere, but then later on within a much greater sphere, some pretty significant influence. And when I think of bartenders, especially bartenders that break onto the world or the national stage, they all have their individual styles, and those styles seem to have some connection to their success. And so what kind of bartender archetype or paradigm did Murray fit into? And maybe if he doesn't fit into one cleanly, like, what did it look like to watch him work behind the bar?
Right. Murray was a very kind of classic old school bartender in many ways. And, Murray had been bartending since at least the 1970s. He'd come up through Seattle and some of the notable bars around the Seattle area, including, two very long stints. He did a very long stint all through the 90s at Il Bistro, which is Pike Place Market. Then he moved over to Zigzag Cafe in the early 2000s, which is about, 150 feet away from Il Bistro. And both of those places and some of the other places, he really cultivated this circle of regulars, just regular clientele, like any good bartender does. People who'd always come in, he always remembered. He was legendary for his memory, for remembering that you'd come in, even if he hadn't seen you for a year, and only if you'd been at his bar once or twice, he remembered that you drank gin and tonics or that you drank Macallan. And he would say Macallan again, or whatever your drink was, he would come back to that, and he would just kind of stay on top of that, and made you feel that kind of attention, made you feel really welcome. He was also legendary within the local hospitality community, and I cannot emphasize this enough, the significance of that, because what it meant was that other bartenders would congregate at his bar on their nights off to learn. Part of it was to network, part of it was to gripe, like any group of people who all work together, work in the same profession. But it was how you found a job. It was how you connected with other bartenders. It was how you learned about Scotch whiskey, how you learned about beer. You learned that at Murray's bar. But you also learned the art of bartending. And I don't just mean cocktails at this. I don't even mean cocktails at this point, because it was like how to work a 12 top. You've got this group of people sitting in front of you. How do you keep them all engaged with you? How do you keep them all engaged with the bar, with their drinks, with each other? And how do you make it a fun environment? And that was really what his mastery was. And that was what so many bartenders would come watch him do. In the early 2000s, obviously we're talking about cocktails at this point. I think, part of the reason, this is a multi-prong answer, but part of the reason Murray got into cocktails was because his customers were getting into cocktails. And like anything else, it was a way to distinguish the bar where you were from its competition.
Yeah, that's interesting. And when you say a 12 top, you're referring to the I'm
talking about the actual bar, like the actual bar top where you've got, this array of faces. Some of them are there every Monday. You know exactly who that person is. They're going to be there from 5:30 to 7:30, and this is exactly what they're going to drink. But then also like all of these just passive people passing through. And we need to remember that, the two bars where he worked the longest, Il Bistro and Zigzag Cafe, they're both in and around Pike Place Market, which is, for people not familiar with Seattle, is a major tourist destination. So you always have out-of-towners coming through who just like accidentally wander into one of the best parts in the country and, you know, order a vodka soda. And he wouldn't bat an eye. Of course, vodka soda, you got it. And they would swear up and down that was the best vodka soda they ever had.
It, the way you describe it and the way that I've read about the Zigzag Cafe in particular is it seems like it's a very intimate space. And the way that you're describing it, I can't help personally, now maybe this is part of like the historiography and the eras that you're describing that Murray had bartended through, but I'm picturing the set of Cheers.
Kind of. If Cheers was much darker and had like a sultry jazz soundtrack going on and was much more cocktail bar oriented, then yeah, okay, maybe somewhat. You know, I've been a regular at Zigzag for close to 20 years now. More than 20 years now. Wow. that's something to think about. It's they're the same group of people for, you know, to some extent who have been going down there and have been regulars at that bar for years and years and years. And there have been people I've known for, you know, the better part of two decades who I've met at that bar. I've seen them many times at the bar. I've seen them at other events, but like really it's like, I know you from Zigzag. I know you from hanging out there. And it's like been the kind of place. Murray was excellent at cultivating this, but even in the years since he left the bar, it's still a great bar. It's still like cultivating that kind of environment and that kind of camaraderie among its clientele.
It's interesting that you've highlighted both Murray's influence on the clientele, but also on the local bartending community, because it seems like there's a couple of things going on. There's obviously a spreading activation, right? We'll talk about his sort of entrance onto the national and international stage in a moment here, but there's also what's called in like certain complex systems communities what's known as betweenness centrality, right? So you've got this central node in a network that for some reason just has all these connections going to it, and not just connections to a single type of group, but connections to all these different types of groups and little sub-communities in the web. And it seems like Murray really had this kind of betweenness centrality that transcended a lot of like sort of self-contained cloisters and allowed him to exert this influence.
Right. And I think, you know, in a way, when I looked at it, and I thought about this a lot more just recently with Murray's passing and with his memorial service a couple of months ago, is, you know, what kind of world did he inhabit? And the world he inhabited is very different from the one that a lot of us do, because he was a lifelong hospitality worker. So his life was lived in bars and restaurants. Yeah, he had a home life, he had, you know, personal life with the friends and things of that nature. But really, Murray lived in the environment of restaurants and bars. These were the people he knew. He knew the owners. He knew the wait staff. He knew the back of house staff. He knew the bartenders. He knew everybody all around town. And part of it was because of, like I said earlier, where he was this kind of node for, especially for local bartenders. If you want to come in and learn, but you could also come in and say, hey, I'm looking for work. Do you know anybody who's hiring? And he could make that connection for you. Or if he thought you had talent and had skills, he would point you in the direction of a certain place, say, go, you know, I think they're hiring a bar back. Get in there. You make your case. I know you're going to, you know, wind up on the staff there because you really got something that you should be in a place like that. So he really inhabited this kind of sphere where he lived openly. You know, it's a way of living in a city where you're living with a very particular class in that city and living very publicly. You know, you're living in public spaces, but you're engaging with the people that a lot of us who just go to bars and restaurants don't necessarily think about. You know, aren't always paying attention to the person bussing your table or the person in the kitchen. He knew all of these folks and he made these connections and he lived that kind of world.
It's a weird cycling of inside and outside if you think about it, right? Because in cities, like a lot of people who live in like really big cities like New York will often say like, well, you know, my apartment's so small that I don't have a living room. My living room is the bar down the block from me where I go to, you know, hang out with friends. And so there's almost like, yes, he's living very publicly. And yet when people come into his bars, he's fulfilling their very private needs. So I think that's a really interesting juxtaposition. And, you know, the first moment when I had the idea to have this conversation with you was when I was interviewing our mutual friend, Henry Price, and we were talking about how Chartreuse had blown up following the explosion of The Last Word Cocktail. And I recalled that, you know, I'd read several articles mentioning Murray's role in the kind of propagation of mm-hmm. this cocktail across, you know, big cities in the US and eventually around the world. So can you kind of walk us through that process and what that looked like? Were you there to kind of be a fly on the wall for that?
For the last word?
Yeah.
I wasn't there at the development of his last word thing, but oddly enough, that was one of the first things that kind of hooked me into coming in there. Mm. The way that it happened from what I understand from Murray telling me the story over the years is that, you know, he had this interest in old cocktail books and old bartending books. And, you know, partially for the recipes, partially just kind of like glimpses into the, you know, old insight into those parts of the culture. And the last word, the recipe appeared, the only reference I know of and that I've seen was in a book called Bottoms Up that came out, I'm not going to remember the exact publication date, it was right around 1950, 1949, yeah, 1950.
Early 50s, I think.
Yeah, somewhere in there. And this was a collection of recipes largely from restaurants and bars and hotels across the United States. Couple of international recipes in there. And it was just kind of like all gathered together with some kind of saucy, risque illustrations as well. And the last word, you know, was sourced back to Detroit and it just had this one line, you know, description about it. And the thing was, you know, when you look at it, it's equal parts gin, lime juice, maraschino liqueur, and green chartreuse. It sounds awful. It sounds like a train wreck. You know, when you first read it on paper, it's like it's half liqueur. You got some gin and then, you know, a little bit of lime juice in there. What the hell's going on? So it's one of those things that I think for a lot of people, well, first off, not many people were looking through this book from 1953, looking for recipes. But if you did, you'd brush past it and say, that's weird, and just go to the next one, looking for something a little bit more, you know, might resonate a little bit more as something Manhattan-ish or something like that. Murray would settle on the weird. Murray also had a thing for, I think it was initially chartreuse, but also maraschino. He liked big, huge flavors, those kinds of vivid things. He loved Campari. He loved Scotch whiskey, like the big, vivid things. And these were, you know, this was a collection of big, vivid things in one glass. But I think also it was the kind of thing where like, well, nobody else is doing that. I can make it into a cocktail. It's not bad. Put it on the menus, trot it out there. Nobody else in town, absolutely nobody else in town or in the world for that matter, is going to have this on their menu. It's going to help distinguish us as a bar. And, you know, when you had the first few cocktail fanatics like Robert Hess coming in and trying it out and saying, oh my God, what is that? Then that's how it started to spread.
Yeah, I love that. The kind of big, distinct, weird stuff.
This episode is brought to you by the Modern Bar Cart Podcast Annual Ratings and Review Drive. That's right, we're collecting all those 5-star reviews and kindly written ratings that no longer fit you and trying to find them a home on our Apple Podcasts and Spotify pages. I'd encourage you to remember that every spring, podcasters just like me are in need of ratings and reviews, and you can help by donating just a minute of your time. Here's a recent review so generously given by our listener Sarah on Apple Podcasts. She says, "The Modern Bar Cart Podcast has become one of my favorites for professional development. It helps remind me to keep learning and progressing in my career developing cocktails, training bartenders, and teaching the public. Thank you." Thank you, Sarah, and thanks to everyone whose generous tax-deductible ratings and reviews on Spotify and Apple Podcasts are helping to keep podcasters just like me off the streets. Now, back to the show.
And Murray was also a music fan, right? Mm-hmm. He was an audiophile?
Yeah, absolutely. He had, I never saw it in person, but I know he had a significant vinyl collection at home, along with turntables and his speakers. And, you know, a couple of times over the years, we'd get together for lunch or for a drink in the afternoon. And we would go to a place downtown where, you know, for me as like a cocktail nerd, I'm like, why are we here? Just kind of like, you know, this is just kind of random bar. And he would go there because they had the massive vinyl selection. It's like, hey, you know, they're playing like British Invasion stuff this afternoon. And he was just in the mood to, you know, hear some Herman's Hermits. But no, he was a huge audiophile, which actually was like totally fitting of this time at Zig Zag, because, you know, it was the thing I always remember about Zig Zag, and the thing that always strikes me every time I walk through the door is you open the door and you just hear a saxophone. You know, you're just going to hear jazz as soon as that door opens. And it was just so in keeping with that whole kind of like cocktail lounge environment and the natural environment where I first met him when he was working for so many years. It just seemed to be so much a part of his personality.
Mm. Yeah, and I don't know, something about the audiophile, the bizarre nature of the last word, and you know what I'm starting to understand as Murray's style of hospitality, and you know it occurs to me that like you know maybe I'll pose this to you, but like isn't you know potentially one of the great pleasures of like going to a bar, especially alone, mm-hmm. you know maybe if you're not with a big group of people, to like you know have a drink and then maybe have another drink and mm-hmm. then at some point. Like become comfortable and at home enough mm-hmm. to like spill your little unique weirdness to the yeah, bartender.
Absolutely. You know, and you know, your unique little weirdness, you know, Murray probably soaked up so much of that over the years from many people, including myself. But yeah, you know, the ability, see, here's one of the things that Murray did in his bar that honestly I don't see very often. And I really truly miss, which is exactly what you said, being able to go into a bar, sit by myself and know that I'm not going to be alone. I'm not going to be lonely during the hour, 2 hours, whatever I am in there. You've got a bartender to engage with. He's going to chat with you a little bit. But also, he's going to make sure that if the person sitting next to you is somebody he thinks you should know, that you're going to wind up talking to him. He's going to somehow strike up that conversation, make that engagement happen. And that was one of his skills, as I was mentioning early on, as a bartender, that other bartenders would go sit at his bar and go, wow, look at that. You know, because it's relatively easy to have, you know, 10 seats in front of you and have them filled with 10 strangers. And where mm-hmm. nobody engages, everybody just kind of stares at their phone or, you know, drinks their cocktail, ignores everything around them. Murray would engage. Murray would make sure that you engaged with him, with the other folks at the bar, so that you would walk out, you know, a lot of times having made a new friend or just thinking, wow, that was just a good time. I enjoyed myself tonight.
Yeah. So I'm curious a little bit as we wrap up here about what happened when Murray got a little bit bigger in terms of his earned reputation with the last word. He was named by Tales of the Cocktail as the nation's best bartender at one point. That got him a lot of attention. Were you there to see like what happened when he kind of hit that more national stage?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I had been writing about Murray some for Imbibe. I had written about him in the New York Times and Zig Zag Cafe for a piece I was working on for them. And, you know, so you saw his reputation spreading. And it was kind of interesting. In the years before the Tales of the Cocktail thing, he was known internationally. You know, you would have bartenders from London, or from Germany or from New York, they would park themselves at Zig Zag because, like, this is the place you got to go. You know, I remember going in there and Angus Winchester coming in, you know, who was the Tanqueray brand ambassador at the time, you know, coming in to see the bar and to kind of marvel at what Murray did. At that point, I was traveling, like, I'd go to a bar in New York City and somebody would be telling me about this cool experience they had in Seattle and Murray, like, you know, like, yep, I know exactly what you mean, man. So when the Tales of the Cocktail thing happened, when he won American Bartender of the Year, the thing was, Murray wasn't going to Tales of the Cocktail anymore at that point. He was kind of annoyed with the event and with the owner at the time, and he didn't want to carve out time for it. He asked me to go in his stead to the awards ceremony. Mm-hmm. I was sitting there, and honestly, I didn't think he was going to win that night because it was, you know, it's awards a lot of times go for, you know, what's current, what's flashy, what's popular, and there are some heavy names on the list. And so I was sitting there when they called his name. I'm like, oh crap, I didn't prepare for this. So I got up on stage, gave the acceptance speech for Murray, and I said something along the lines of, if you know Murray at all, then you know he's way too cool to show up at a place where somebody's going to try to give him an award, which was entirely true. And I remember I came off stage and you know, I stepped out in the hallway to call him on my cell phone and say, hey Murray, you won the award. And I'll always remember his girlfriend picked up the phone and, you know, asked what it was. And I said, hey, can I talk to Murray? You know, he just got an award. And she's, hang on a sec. I could hear him kind of mumbling in the background. Then she came back on the phone and said, can you call him back later? We're in the middle of a movie. And I'm like, you know, that would be exactly his attitude toward being given an award. Like, oh, okay, great. When I got home, when I came home with his, you know, crystal plate from Tales of the Cocktail and gave it to him, and they stuck by the bar. Things got weird, you know? You would have just groups show up who would read about this, because made the local papers all over the internet. And you'd have groups of people show up who, you know, were never in bars before, or heard, you know, Murray was great at, you know, doing the bartender's choice cocktail. But people would always be like, I don't know, can you make me something? I'm kind of feeling sad or kind of cold or whatever today. And it just became too much, you know? It became just a zoo at the bar. It always been a very kind of placid, kind of cool place. Weekends, sure, it'd be busy, it'd be packed, but it was a hopping bar, you know, a very fun bar. This became almost like, you know, tourist central. And it was just kind of too much. It was too much for him. It was too much for the rest of the staff. It just got kind of weird for a while. And, you know, I remember used to be my regular night was Wednesday nights. I would always go Wednesday night at opening, you know, go park at one end of the bar. Usually, you know, a few people would come in, but it was never too crazy. I remember the first weekend, first week I came down, and there was a lineup outside the bar before opening. And I thought, oh my God, what just happened here? So, you know, it got a little strange, and he left Zigzag not too long after that. I think partially just it was, you know, he just needed a change at that point.
It's interesting. It seems like, I can't remember the name of the, sociologist or anthropologist who came up with this, but there's a certain number or threshold of people we can kind of contain within our minds and within a given community. Mm-hmm. And it seems like Murray was maybe more talented than most at, you know, incorporating a slightly larger group of people and preferences, remembering their drinks and being able to, like you've described, kind of fluidly navigate all those different situations in this kind of bustling city place, but also in his own, you know, kind of carved out niche within that city. And it seems like the attention from Tales of the Cocktail just kind of blew past that threshold of, you know, whatever number of people and details we can kind of hold at once and be able to navigate. And that makes entirely all the sense in the world to me based on the style of bartender he seems to have been.
Just a little interjection from the future here. That number that I'm talking about is called Dunbar's number, named after British anthropologist Robin Dunbar, who studied primate brain size relative to the sizes of their social groups. Interestingly, for the purposes of this chat, here's how Wikipedia describes it. Quote, Dunbar explained the principle informally as the number of people you would not feel embarrassed about joining uninvited for a drink if you happen to bump into them at a bar. By using the average human brain size and extrapolating from the results of primates, Dunbar proposed that humans can comfortably maintain about 150 stable relationships. All right, now back to Paul.
Yeah, you know, I think the whole cocktail thing blowing up, he would, you know, he knew what I did and he knew that I was becoming a professional off of this, but he would always, you know, he would never fail to roll his eyes. So, you know, when things got a little too serious about cocktails, you're like, geez, people, it's just a drink, you know? Yeah. And he'd been doing this for so long. He identified more as a bartender as, you know, making sure people had a good time. You know, that somebody came in, if they're on a date, they had a good time. If somebody came in and wanted to be left alone, they got left alone. He valued that much more than he did the cocktails. And when the cocktail thing kind of blew up, and people started coming down there, he would go along with it because, of course, people are coming to your bar. They're spending money. You know, that's what it's all about ultimately, right? But I remember one time there was an event going on in town, bar. You know, with Dave Wondridge and Dale DeGroff and Paul Packle and all those guys when they do their bar 5-day. But they also did the Bar Smart. It's like a 1-day in-person kind of class. They did in Seattle 1 year. And they're doing it just up the street from Zigzag. And I remember I came into the bar, you know, at opening time on the day that they're doing this class and thought, I'm going to meet a bunch of folks down here when class lets out and they'll head down. And, you know, it came a point where it was just like a boom because the door opened and like all of a sudden, like at the bar, just boom, 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 it was Dale DeGraw, Paul Peckle, Audrey Saunders hanging out there, Robert Hess. I was sitting there just, you know, we're having cocktails and like every bartender basically from Portland, Oregon to Vancouver, British Columbia was packed into that bar. Just bang. And I was being told this later on by Eric Hakkinen, who was working in the service well and who now the owner of Roquette in Seattle. And he said at one point, you know, it was just crazy. It was like, you know, every kind of like bar, serious bartender, you know, famous bartender in the country was in that room. And at one point, Casey Fitch, who at that time was the co-owner of Zigzag, working away in the service wall, and turned and said, "Who are all these people again?" So part of the reason I tell it is because, you know, Zigzag became known for the cocktails. Murray became known as a cocktail bartender, but they were never about that. You know, yeah. That's never what the focus of the place was. It was supposed to be just a good bar. And I think when that all of that attention came in on Murray after the Tales of the Cocktail, it was like, you know, it's not about me making cocktails. It's about me making a room full of people happy. Mm. And, you know, when you have these hordes coming in, he no longer felt really able to do that, I think.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, it kind of leads me to our final question, which is about Murray's legacy. Now, obviously, you've sort of described in narrative terms some of the stories that were impactful and some of the large scale like changes and trends that he was a part of. But I'm curious if there are any like more like quirky things or intimate details or just overall takeaways that you think that bartenders today who are maybe just getting started on their journey as cocktail bartenders might be able to take away from what Murray was uniquely good at.
You know, I think one of the things Murray was uniquely good at was just this aspect of engagement with people across from him. And engagement can take many forms. It can be direct engagement. Hey, how are you doing? How are the kids? You know, what are you drinking tonight? That kind of thing. But it'd also be a passive engagement where he knows that maybe you need some time. Maybe you just want to hang out for a little while, or maybe you're on a date, maybe you're the couple, let you talk for a little while. But being very aware of what's going on with you the entire time that you're there. Mm. You know, if you can hear like a date's conversation starting to lag, come over there, tell a joke, do something, get it back together. If it seemed like, you know, people are not getting along, go over, figure out a way to kind of intervene in a way where nobody realizes you're intervening. At his memorial service, you know, a lot of people were sharing tons of stories. And, you know, Ben Dougherty, who was the current owner of Zigzag and one of the partners in Zigzag back when Murray was there, would tell the story of, you know, this guy coming to the bar, sitting at the bar, and basically he needed to be 86th. You know, he'd had too much to drink. He was getting a little out of control, and he just needed to be escorted out. Murray figured out a way to not only get the guy out of the bar, but to get the guy to leave a tip and to think he just made a best friend. You know, he had figured out a way to, you know, this guy is a menace, get him out. And the guy walked out walking on cloud nine, you know.
Amazing.
And it was just that kind of interpersonal skill. So to your question of are there things that bartenders can take away from this, you know, it sounds hokey, but it's about the people in front of you and realizing every person has a need in front of you. Sometimes it's for a cocktail, sometimes for conversation, sometimes it's a lot more, and many times it's many things. So realizing and focusing on that kind of interpersonal dynamic and how you function as part of that in a bar.
Yeah. Well, when we look at our social media feeds in the cocktail and bartending world, you know, what do you see most often is just a picture of a drink, you know, a beautiful drink in a glass. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I feel like that tends to be the, you know, if we're looking at this as through a lens or a camera, it's like, ooh, the lens is very much at this, you know, kind of zeroed in on what's on the bar as opposed to who's on the other side of the bar and whoa, the more of like the widescreen version of what's going on. So it seems like that lens is really useful and something that Murray always had sort of at his disposal to help with his hospitality. So Paul, I want to thank you for coming on the podcast and sharing all these great stories about Murray, but also some of the significance and some takeaways for our bartenders today. So tell our listeners where they can find your work and where they can subscribe to your podcast.
Well, you can find all of the above at imbibemagazine.com. We've got our podcast archives. We've got how to subscribe to the magazine. Always subscribe to the magazine. And all of our social media feeds linked right there, imbibemagazine.com.
Beautiful. And if you're like me, you'll go to your podcast app and you'll subscribe to Radio Imbibe, which is part of my regular podcasting diet. So, Paul, once again, thanks for being a guest on the Modern Bar Cart podcast.
Thanks so much, Eric.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, there's a couple things you can do to help the show. One would be to rate and review this program anywhere you enjoy listening to podcasts, especially on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. The more ratings and reviews we have, the easier it will be for other like-minded flavor nerds to enjoy the content that I produce. You can also follow the Modern Bar Cart YouTube channel, where I post video clips from the podcast and beyond. And you can join our growing Discord community, which is where our listeners submit questions for upcoming guests and chat about all kinds of fun spirits and cocktail shenanigans. It's also where I share fun perks and discounts that are too exclusive to blast out on the airwaves. To join our community Discord server or get in touch with me for any other reason, all you need to do is drop me a line by emailing podcast@modernbarcart.com. This episode may be over, but for you, the mixological fun and boozy adventures are just beginning. So remember, drink responsibly and experiment boldly. This episode was made possible with editing and sound design by Samantha Reed, cocktail history and culture insights courtesy of Paul Clark, hospitality lessons from the late, great Murray Stenson, and a little bit of interview magic by yours truly. This has been a Direct Fire Studios production, copyright 2024.